on these millennials, right? Yeah, they're just ruining all of our fun, aren't they? Yeah. I tell you, every generation needs a punching bag. Somebody to punch down on. And the millennials are it, man. I mean, they're really taking it from all sides. Yeah, even the Gen Zs are harsh on millennials. You know, these Gen Zs who were born around the year 2000 or later. I know because I used to teach Gen Zs. I used to teach high schoolers. And yeah, they would sit in class sometimes and say, you know, these millennials, you know, they're too entitled. They think that they're entitled to everything. $15 an hour. More bathroom breaks at Amazon. Yeah, I mean, they sound like the Gen Zers. They sound like just old rednecks in Maine sitting on the porch in rocking chairs, whittling. Oh, man, talking about the good old days. Yeah, millennials just get it from every direction. I guess they're perceived, yes, to be entitled, to be lazy, to just think that they... The world did not exist before they were born. That's the general consensus. I think that's the way every generation is perceived. But specifically, the millennials. Remember the days when we couldn't even find a term to describe these people. People like me, I'm a millennial. Yeah, I was born in 1982. I'm what they call an elder millennial. Like, I'm a Gandalf millennial. I have a little bit of wisdom, I guess. I remember the internet in its infancy. I can take a pipe and like blow, make big shapes with my puffs. I don't know. But yeah, they used to not even know what to call the millennials, and now that they finally have a name for them, right, they receive a lot of ire. Okay, and just when you think it's over, it's. Coming back strong. You know, like right now they've got this quiet quitting thing. This term that's come up in recent months and weeks. It says quiet quitters. I'm on Gallup here. Quiet quitters make up at least 50% of the U.S. workforce, probably more. The trend toward quiet quitting, the idea spreading virally on social media. Social media, you know, immediately millennials are into that. Millions of people are not going above and beyond at work, and just meeting their job description could get worse. Yeah. U.S. employee engagement took another step backward during the second quarter of 2022, with the proportion of engaged workers remaining at 32%, but the proportion of actively disengaged increasing to 18%. I don't want to read all this math. You know, I'm a millennial. Yeah, but there are reports, though, that most of these people are, you know, under the age of 40, over the age of 22 or whatever. You know, they are millennials, okay? And they're quiet quitting. They want to come into work and do the bare amount possible. Yeah, which I guess, you know, I understand to a degree. Now... work, the office, employers are ubiquitous. You know, we take our phones home with us. We're expected to check our emails and answer texts from our bosses and things like that. And that can get very problematic. And people are just like, nope, turn it off. 5 o'clock, turn it off. Right? I'm living my own life now. You know, they're saying that these employment environments are toxic. Right? That's a word they like to use. Toxic. It's bad for my mental health and all that stuff. And I'm not downplaying this at all. These are totally valid points. Okay. I think quiet quitting, there's a place for it. Like, I think if you worked at a place like Chipotle, you could quiet quit from there. You could, you know, clock out, turn your phone off. And if your manager, you know, calls you and says, you know, come down here and start making some burritos and you're off time, you know, you can say no. I don't know if it would really work well so much for, you know, a professional environment, right? Like coming from my background as a teacher, I could not quiet quit being a teacher. because most of the work that goes into being a teacher is, you know, done outside of the hours of 8 to 4. You have to grade papers, take those home with you, lesson plan and all that stuff, right? Yeah, you know, I just so I don't really know if it's a thing that you can get away with for too long. But that being said, I don't think the millennials, I don't think it's just, you know, restricted to them. Oh, but yeah, yeah. I have had, that being said, I have had my own problems with quiet quitting millennials. And yeah, in the case that I witnessed not too long ago on a vacation with my wife, you know, I just noticed that they're not really sticking it to the man. They think that they're martyrs, you know, just turning their phones off and quiet quitting. They're not sticking it to the man. What they're really doing is they're, like, you know, screwing you over. They're sticking it to their fellow man. This happened recently, and I want you to stick around, okay? Because this is a real story, okay? And it's not just me ranting, okay? An old elder millennial ranting against the young people who are giving my generation a bad name, okay? I'm about to tell you a very, you know, in-depth story that has a lot more to do with the state of millennials and where they really are. I don't know. Stick around. This is the Midnight Citizen Show. I am your host, Mike Booty, and yeah, we've got a unique jaunt for you tonight through the annals of time. Yeah, it all basically started. My wife and I wanted to take a trip, right? So we booked one. You know, we were like all these other Americans out there. We get very tired, very worn down with life. We want to get out of the rat race. You know, we both work. But this vacation had to be a little bit different because we've taken so many vacations in the past. And we're really just tired of the whole vacation experience in general. You know, you get on a plane or you're in a car or whatever, and you know, it's a very uncomfortable experience. You're all scrunched up for hours, and then you check into the hotel or you go out for dinner, and you just have to deal with like a lot of tired employees. You know, most of them are just shirking their jobs, doing the bare amount possible, you know, looking at their phones. And then you just end up in some kind of second-rate motel, convalescing from your days with a bunch of other worn-out tourists just like you. You know, just wonder what it's all about. You know, you stroll the main streets and you go into all these shops that are not really authentic to the place where you are. You know what I mean? It's like they're condensing, they're selling a cartoon version of the place where you are, right? You might as well just be on television. They're giving you all the highlights, okay? You know, and there's, oh my God, there's like Christmas shops and fudge shops and old-timey photo booths where you go in and, I don't know, for a buck of five, you know, you dress like a cowboy and hold a fake Daisy air rifle. And you know, you get a sepia tone picture taken of yourself. You know, it's just, yeah, it's honestly like most vacations now, right? It's like you've already taken the vacation before you've even gone on it. And my wife and I didn't want that, right? You know, we wanted something new. We wanted an old school vacation that wasn't like corrupted by the idea of it being a vacation. You know, most places you go, everything is made for you. It's designed for you. And that's supposed to be a selling point. You know, you're not supposed to just be like a stranger that just gets jerked around all the time, or just like some nobody that blends into the background. You know, you're supposed to be the star of whatever vacation you go to. Right? Like at all the restaurants, they're supposed to bring you, dishes that are like on fire. You know, you go to Disney World and like the beauty, the beast asks you to a dance or whatever. I don't know. But we wanted to do this thing where we just wanted to blend into an environment, right? We wanted to be non-tourist, non-participants of a sort. Just blend in rather than like having everything catered to us as tourists, right? And we wanted to go to these places that, like some place, we wanted to go to some place that had not realized how touristy it could get someday. We wanted to go to some place that had been uncorrupted, right? And that's basically all distilled into the tagline of the Get Back Travel Agency. The tagline was, live in the then, right? Live in the then. Yeah, we had seen the commercials on TV, like everybody else on late night television. And, you know, I got to be honest, it all seemed dubious, you know, this idea of time at tourism. Being a tourist, but traveling back in time, going someplace else. And doing what I just said I wanted to do, you know, just explore someplace before it became like, you know, go to Nashville, Tennessee before Johnny Cash recorded his first album there. I don't know. Go to Alaska before the U.S. bought it. I don't know. And started, you know, drilling for oil there or something. But yeah, I will be honest, the ads seemed dubious, like how could this possibly happen, like time travel? That's interesting. Even more so is where the Get Back Travel Agency was located. You know, it was located in the River Chase Galleria, and almost no successful stores located in the River Chase Galleria. But yeah, it was there at the very end, in a little tiny, you know, storefront between the H&M and the abandoned closed down Sears. So I just wasn't sure about this, but on the television commercial, you know, the song by the Beatles, you know, Get Back played, and we're like, wow, this agency must have a little bit of money and credibility to get a song like that. Cause the Beatles don't like to give their music to no one or whoever owns the Beatles music now. Right. Yeah. So, yeah, we walked in here, and the door, a little bell over the door jingled as we walked in, and we were greeted by a man who seemed like he would be our travel agent. He shook our hands. His name was Mr. Van Allen. And he was basically the model of a typical, you know, sit-behind-a-desk pencil pusher. When he coughed, he would... You know, his cough was like the ghost of 1,000 cigarettes that had died a hot death in his mouth. And he had that, like, good old boy sense of humor, right? He said to me, like, yeah, before you say anything, I've heard all the jokes about my name, you know? My belt's like the universe. It's always expanding, right? He said as he took us and set us down at his desk, right? And yeah, as he was kind of shuffling through some papers, getting all of our preliminary information that we had given him over the internet, you know, I just took a look around and just saw, you know, that the decor was essentially like any other travel agency, you know. They were very, very plain looking. It could have been an insurance office if not for, you know, some signs on a wall, right? Yeah, in between like the plastic ficuses and like a water cooler. There are these big signs that advertised different places where you can travel to with taglines and pictures like the mid-century modern, you know, retro pictures that you would see of tourism destinations. You know, there was one picture advertising. It said 1066, the Battle of Hastings. Pick a side. And I guess you could choose, like, what side you wanted to be on, the invading French or the Saxons, right? There was another one that had a big, you know, picture of three ships and a little guy, you know, pointing towards some land. And over it, it said 1492, the year you sailed the ocean blue. You know, this is kind of interesting. I don't know. So, yeah, he handed my wife and I some papers. And in these papers were just a bunch of options, a bunch of, like, trip options, you know, running through, like, a variety of timelines that we could actually visit and see, you know. Now, I know what you might think, okay? So, like, this is a time travel agency. They figured out time travel so we could just go anywhere we wanted in the history of time, like Bill and Ted. Well, it doesn't work like that, as I quickly found out, okay? Yeah, he said that there's this whole process to building up a timeline before somebody from 2022 can basically go see it, right? There's a lot of logistics involved. He said essentially there are agents, you know, travel agents who go ahead of time, and they basically have to engineer scenarios. They have to drop you to a specific point at a very specific place on the time continuum where your presence would not disturb anything in the long run, you know, like in cause, whatever you want to call it, the butterfly effect, right? You know, a sound of thunder or whatever. And this made sense. You know, it was very much in the way that, like, Disney World is engineered. You know, you can't just go into Disney World before they've made a new land. It wouldn't be interesting. It wouldn't be fun, right? And, yeah, you have to give them some time before it's open to the public, and I understood that. So they had a very, since this is a very new venture, okay, they had a very limited amount of timelines that were open, okay? But they were very interesting, though. You know, I was looking for the brochures. You know, I saw that one timeline said, you know, Lincoln's assassination, right? Of course, it didn't say this in the brochure. It was advertised, you know, for reasons of taste as, like, dinner and a show. And this was interesting, and I asked Mr. Van Allen, I said, you know, wouldn't someone want to prevent Lincoln's assassination? Like, I always thought that's what I would do. If I were to go back in time, I would want to, like, I don't know, prevent the Titanic from sinking or save Abraham Lincoln or maybe, you know, kill Adolf Hitler or something. And he said, yeah, no, that's what everybody says, right? But no, I mean, our agents essentially research every scenario. They would make sure that if you were in that timeline, if you were in the Ford's Theater, seeing an American cousin the night that Lincoln was killed, you know, there would be no way you could get there in time. They drop you in basically right before the assassination and, you know, so you get to witness it, but you can't do anything about it. Okay. So I, yeah. Okay. This made sense to me. I mean, this is very, they really did think of everything, right? Yeah. So yeah, I mean, finally I looked through and I saw something that I really liked and Jessica really enjoyed. And we saw that we could actually visit Chicago in 1893, right? We could be there. We could see the Columbian Exposition, this big fair that was put on to celebrate the, what is it, 500-year anniversary of Columbus, right, landing in America. And this was really perhaps the greatest show that the United States has ever seen. It was a real turning point for the Midwest, right, and America in general, right? And not only that, we could go there, we could ride the first ever Ferris wheel, right? We could see Buffalo Bill do his Wild West show. And we could be among the first in history to taste Pabst Blue Ribbon beer. You know, like, we were there. This would be amazing. Let's do it, you know? Of course, as we learned soon, we would have to call it just Pabst. It was not until the end of the fair that it was awarded the Blue Ribbon as the best beer in America. Yeah, I mean, we thought it was strange and just a little disheartening that so much had to be engineered. You know, I mean, we weren't looking for this kind of thing. I mean, again, this seemed like they were catering everything to our experience rather than just, like, allowing us to be, I don't know, the proverbial flies on the wall, right? But I don't know. You know, it's time travel, so you had to make a few caveats, you know. So, yeah, the first thing we had to do is we had to, like, blend in. OK, Okay, this is very a big deal. You can't just show up in the past, okay, wearing you know, Nikes and sunglasses and things like that, you know? They take you to a place where you have to get new clothes, period clothes that have actually been taken from the period, not manufactured now in some kind of a Chinese sweatshop, okay? So they dress us up. We have to get new clothes. We have to exchange our currency. So we have to give them our modern money, okay? And we have to give them our modern money, and we have to exchange them for 1893 money. And this is a little bit disheartening for me because, you know, obviously they don't have credit cards in 1893, so I can't get the points at all on this vacation. So I have to use cash for everything, which is kind of, you know. But the most interesting thing is about going back in time is that you're like a spy, you know? Like, we were given new identities. We couldn't just go back as ourselves. You know, so we were given new identities, Mr. and Mrs. Heppelwhite, you know, dairy farmers from Cedar Rapids, Iowa. And we had to work. It was actually a process. We had to go for several weeks in a row before we took the trip itself. And we had to work with a diction coach for several afternoons. And, you know, we had to work with some historians and some linguists, you know, to like learn the popular expressions of the day so that we wouldn't, you know, stick out like a sore thumb in 1893. You know, so like, for instance, we would go back and we would say things like, oh, you know, like, we're not on vacation. We were there to see the elephant, right? This is a popular term we were told from the 1890s that basically means that, you know, you're in town to see the whole thing, even the shady sides. And it would help us, you know, fit in as like some tourist in the big city, right? Just a couple of farmers, right? Yeah, if anybody asked us about our farm back in Cedar Rapids, you know, we'd say it's a real lally cooler, you know? Like, very successful operation. That's what allowed us to travel here to Chicago. And if I wanted to sit around in any gentlemen's clubs in Chicago and smoke cigars and drink bourbon with all the other robber barons, yeah, we could talk about those crooks in Washington. I would be like, oh, they're getting too high for their nut. You know, I could say that. That would be, yeah. So, you know, it was a whole process, okay? But the last thing that they did before they kind of got us ready and sent us on our way is they put a like special powder on our fingertips that we had to have on at all times. We could not wash it off. It was like one of those bands they give you, you know, if you're over 21 at like a concert. It's like you rip and pull, you can't get it off. You really cannot get off this powder. It's like Cheetos dust, okay? And basically what it would do is it would like, if we went through, it would flag any unauthorized objects that we touch, okay? Because here in 1893, there are certain things that if you do touch them, you can really mess up the time continuum. And they give you an idea of what you can touch and really where you can go and where you can't go. They said that the agents have done their best to engineer, you know, the World's Fair like a video game level, right? Like, you see the horizon and you think you can go there, but nah, there's always something in the way, like a mountain or whatever, that just directs you back from that horizon, okay? And that's more or less what it's like. But nevertheless, you know, there are certain things in there. They're not very often, but if your Cheetos dust appears on those objects, they'll have to re-engineer the whole thing and all that. And it could affect your trip and all that. And the fascinating thing is we also found out that space-time travel was actually federally regulated. It kind of in the same way of the FAA. And any unauthorized, like, moving or touching of things that, you know, they don't allow could result in an actual penalty of, like, fine or time in jail. So this is actually kind of serious. And so in this case, you know, Mr. Van Allen was a bureaucrat working for the government, kind of helping us navigate all this, right? He was a very helpful one, too, I have to say. Yeah. But, of course, all objects that could tie us to the present had to be left behind. This was a very difficult moment because we, of course, you know, had to give up cell phones. We were allowed to bring a carry-on for the trip that had items that, if they were caught by, like, porters or anybody else, we could explain, you know. It's like, oh, yeah, that, you know, razor there. You know, the razor that is a new kind of razor. Back then, they were all shaving with those straight edges, right? It's like, oh, yeah, that's a new invention that my cousin in Manhattanville has designed, right? Just as long as we could explain it. I don't know how you can explain a smartphone, so yeah. But yeah, nevertheless, the carry-ons, they had to be stowed away in what they called the transport, the vehicle that it would actually get us there to 1893. Okay. And when we got to the transport, we saw that it was an enclosed train car that on both the outside and inside resembled a steam locomotive compartment from the turn of the century. We got on there. I noticed the windows were not allowing us to look at the outside, even though we could actually see a representation of the outside. We found out that I guess they were just cameras or something projecting an image back to us, right? Yeah, they were just a facade of what was directly outside the door, but it was like a televised system. So, yeah, the transport started, and, you know, let me tell you something. Going back in time is not like in the movies. You know, you don't just hit a wall and suddenly, like, you're there where the wall is no longer. Yeah, it takes time, just like traveling any place takes time, because you have to wind back the clock. And you can't just go straight back through time instantaneously, as we soon find out. You'd get sick. So, yeah, it took a while, because we're going 130 years back in time. Yeah, it took several hours. And we killed time just like we would on any other trip. You know, I brought a book to read. I usually like to read books on my way to places that are about the place where I'm going. So in this case, I brought one of my favorite nonfiction books of all time, The Devil in the White City by Eric Larson, you know, which is all about the Chicago World's Fair of 1893. And of course, H.H. Holmes, the America's first serial killer, who stalked that fair. And I was like, oh, I hope I don't run into him. You know, I'm not, I won't. I think I'll be fine. I'm not a single woman, you know. Meanwhile, next to me, Jessica was just reading her, as she always likes to do on vacation. She reads her Sookie Stackhouse books. Yeah. But occasionally we would both get a little bit tired with our reading, and, you know, we just for a change of scenery. You know, like on planes, how you can actually look at the monitor and they show you where over the world you are. Well, the same thing happened here. We could actually flip on a monitor and we could see where in time we were passing over. Okay. And this is like amazing. It was really like the opening credits of that show Quantum Leap. Right. It's like, for instance, 1 minute we were pulling through a scene of great chaos in New York City and like Bruce Springsteen was playing on a stage as we passed by. I thought it was 9/11 at first, but it wasn't. It was like his great Madison Square Garden show in 2000, you know, the one that they recorded and put on the album, you know. Yeah, and then the scene was gone, right? It was like just we were passing through a series of elevated train stations on our way back to the past. You know, each train station was a different time. It's most moments like blowing past us in an instant, and it's like then they were gone. You know, we breezed past the line around the block outside the Man's Chinese Theater advertising Star Wars. You know, we passed through John F. Kennedy Jr. saluting his father's grave. Yeah, troops coming home from World War II, cavorting in Times Square. And then the next moment, they were all leaving for Europe. We were going back in time. And it was all so fast, it was just a blur. And yeah, just after a while, it just kind of gave us a headache. You know, you could definitely... It was possible to get time sickness, is what we learned from the trip. Oh, yes. And then we felt the transport slowing down. Yeah, those windows. They were suddenly materializing around us. They were no longer screens and monitors. They actually were windows, and we could look outside, and we could see steam floating past our window, mixed with dirt and dust, and giving everything outside a rusty tint. We had arrived. Somehow, the transport along the way had turned into part of an 1880s steam locomotive, and we had arrived at the fair. Yes. Yeah, we stepped outside. There was like the smell, the immediate smell that hit you at the stockyards. But then also there was like sausage coming from the other direction, the smell of sausage. So like we didn't know which meat was alive and which had already been dead and cooked. So, yeah. So we walked through the fair, gazing at all the attractions at first and, you know, like making mental notes of what we would like to inspect the most on our way back through, where we would take our time and see things. Okay. So we saw, like, you know, the John Bull locomotive, very famously parked there, the oldest, even in that time, steam locomotive in the United States. And it was still running, not like today. Yeah. It was parked there for the duration of the fair. We saw this gigantic Norway Viking ship, which is exciting to me because I've studied like Old English literature and read Beowulf, and it was so great to actually see one of these Viking ships in the flesh, right? And yeah, and then we walked around and we saw all the pavilions where the various states were represented. And then as we walked further in past the midway, we saw this moving walkway. Like, to us, we get these moving walkways at the airport, but this was the first time anybody had ever seen such a thing. And people were so impressed by it. And as we got on this thing and just moved on basically the world's first people mover, right? I mean, what we realized is that people over 100 years ago, you know, they just want to come tour places and be amused with like just like us. Just like it's always been. They want to come places and be amused with the smallest amount of effort possible. Oh, yes. And then we came to the real thing, right? The real heart of the fair. Through Jackson Park, we saw the White City. Yeah. Of course, I really wanted to come to this timeline to see the architectural model, this marvel that was not built out of stone, even though it looked like it was built out of stone. It was built out of, like, you know, plaster, right? Because it was supposed to be temporary, and they figured out a way to not only make it temporary, but also make it beautiful. And this is one of those things that you cannot see now, of course. You can see the spot. Today in Chicago, there's a plaque where it was, but, you know, it burned down a year after the fair in one of Chicago's great fires, you know. So coming off the people mover, we saw the great neoclassical structure. As we got closer, of course, you know, I noticed that it didn't look that great, and I figured that the Get Back Travel Agency must have dropped us somewhere into the fair's end, right? And you can tell this because it was a very hot summer day and the plaster was peeling and nobody seemed to be like rushing over to make it look nice for all the new tourists. This was really like one of those days for, you know, the fifth and sixth and seventh wave of tourists, you know, the really poor people. And I was wondering if, like, if we paid more, you know, could we have gotten a better time? But I don't know. But yeah, I mean, no matter, you know, the walkways and gardens, around the White City, they were magnificent. And, you know, I began to get this, like, nostalgic feeling, even though I'd never been to the past before. You know, was it like a nostalgia? I just felt this bubbling in my gut. Was it a nostalgia for, like, a past that had never existed? It's like the same feeling strolling through Disney World gives you. Yeah, it's like the same feeling that strolling through Disney World gives you, you know? It's like this engineered experience to make you centralize your own memories and make you think that you've actually been somewhere when indeed you had not, right? Yeah, it was like the same thing. Like, the White City really could have been an early Epcot. You know, you go everywhere and there's just this... yeah, there's this like centralization of history and rewriting it at the same time. Like, I went, you know, the big celebration at the Chicago World's Fair was, of course, to commemorate the 500th anniversary of Columbus. Okay. So there was a big reproduction of the Nina, the Pina, the Pinta, and the Santa Marina, the Nina, the Pinta, and the Santa Marina, right? Is that right? Yeah. And of course, you know, they had done it up beautifully, parked in the harbor there at Lake Michigan. It was gorgeous, but they had re-engineered the scene to make all of these actual Native Americans storming the ship as if, you know, they were savages who couldn't be trusted. And thank God that Columbus was there to make them see the light and convert them to Christ, right? Yeah, it was just one of these things where everybody was standing in awe looking at this scene and you know, seeing it as how they believed it really was, and suddenly that somehow becomes their memory of what the past was. Yeah, it was just all the past that had never happened, but it was now being, you know, reformulated and rewritten by the winners, right? Yeah. And just, I noticed walking around that the America of 1893 was being, you know, bundled and packaged in all these different state pavilions, the same way you would get anywhere else in America in 2022. You know, you go and you don't get an authentic experience. It's all just bundled and wrapped up for you and presented with all the fat cut out of it. Okay. I don't know if I'm explaining this too well. I'll try to give you an example and show you what I mean. So, like, you know, there was the Idaho building showcasing its potatoes. You know, you didn't go there and really see real Idaho. The only idea you would get from about Idaho was that it had potatoes, right? Yeah. I'm sure a bunch of other interesting things happen in Idaho. But no, they just want you to know about their potatoes. And so that's an example of how they just package something up and sell it to you. That's it. That's the one thing, right? Yeah, all the territories were there that hadn't yet been incorporated as estates. And, you know, they were showcasing the promise of, like, the New West, right? The tamed native. And the shotgun, right? I mean, they weren't telling the stories of all the people who truly lived out there, you know, the immigrants who came there to escape discrimination back home. And yeah, that would not sell tickets, right? Yeah. And then all you would know about Louisiana was that they had this thing called the cypress tree, you know, which was, it was really a beautiful tree. It was one of the beautiful, most prettiest trees I'd ever seen. And judging from the crowd around it, you know, they had seen it too, but you know, having just read Eric Larson's book about this fair, which of course wouldn't be published for another, you know, 100 years, I just looked at the cypress tree and I knew that, like, you know, even now it was planting these seedlings in the soil that would become, you know, invasive and overtake the vegetation of the Midwest in the century to come. You know, it would be the same way if we had chosen over this World's Fair and gone to the St. Louis Fair in 1906, you know, we would have seen the same thing with kudzu and privet. You know, I don't know. All right. You know, like, yeah, maybe, I don't know, maybe that's why they stopped doing these World's Fairs, you know, because you can't have one without introducing, you know, some kind of, like, a native plant or invasive plant. So yeah, you know, by this time, we had been at the fair for a while, and the novelty of time travel, I never thought I would say this, was kind of wearing off. I was really starting to get that Epcot vibe. Just walking around, there was a lot of cool things to see. Like, you know, there's cool, you know, they're cool, and there's, like, nothing else like it in the whole world, but I don't know, there's really just nothing to do there except just wander around and look at this, like, manufactured reality. You know, all of it facade. There was a moment then, though, however, where we did see a photo booth, right? And our spirits perked up. We saw this photo booth. Like, photography was really becoming a thing in the 1890s, and here was our chance to see it up close. You know, like, back home on a normal trip, we'd, like, make fun of a place like this. But, you know, this wasn't an old-timey photo booth. This was a new-timey photo booth, right? Before the chump factor kicked in and, you know, ruined old-fashioned photography. Yeah, it was great. Yeah, we went in, and, you know, before we could go to the backdrop, however, this photographer came up to us, and we thought we were just going to take a photo in our normal clothes, and suddenly, you know, he pointed to a big rack of clothes, a series of outfits that we could wear. You know, it's like, would you want to be a cowboy? A lawman? A lady of ill repute for the wife? You know, I told him we just wanted us, right? I just want to be in a picture by ourselves without any pretense or flash, you know? And he just frowned at me. He said, who doesn't want to freeze an image of themselves as they really like to be? So, yeah, we just got our picture taken by a very depressed photographer. And, yeah, when I came out of there, I just thought, you know, I thought a little bit at that moment, I don't know, of breaking the rules, you know, like actually leaving the fair, risking the fines of the federal regulations and just going outside of Chicago. And maybe getting on a train and, like, heading out west where there were still real cowboys. And I could actually see the real authentic world of 1893 rather than just a representation of it, you know. But then I looked down at my hands and I remembered and I saw the Cheeto dust, you know. And I just thought about how, you know, I'm still paying off a car. I can't really afford the stiff pines. Whatever. No, I looked around and just wondered, you know, if there were any other time tourists like us at the fair, you know, other people who were there just like us and in the same reality, time tourists, we were told that there may be some, but, you know, if we saw somebody else that we suspected of being just like us from 2022, just to maybe politely nod at them, but maybe don't engage them because it could throw up things, right? So, yeah, I suddenly just kind of tried to fight my boredom a little bit by looking around and trying to spot other time tourists. It wasn't that hard, actually, because, you know, you knew they were there, right? Like, every time you saw, like, a fat person, somebody who was somewhat obese walking around with a forlorn face, yeah, you knew that was them. They were from your time, you know, looking around, just basically looking angry that they were seeing all the stuff that they didn't understand, but, you know, they wanted to take a picture with it anyway. And finally we rounded a corner near the back of the fair. And yeah, we heard this voice yelling at us. It's like, see all of the fair from Mr. Ferris's wheel. Oh my gosh. In all this like excitement, I had completely forgotten that this was where the Ferris wheel debuted. You know, the Ferris wheel was built by George Ferris as like a response to the, what is it, 1892 Parisian exhibition where the Eiffel Tower was debuted. And we could not just, this is objectively more exciting than the new timey photo booth, of course, because I mean, this was not just a Ferris wheel we were about to ride. This was the Ferris wheel, the prototype. Right? I got so excited about it. Got on this thing. Right. But, you know, like instantly as it, you know, we felt it lift up and we went, I don't know, what was it, about 100 feet or so into the air. And we started to see, you know, the World's Fair below us. As the sun was setting on it, you know, the peeling plaster of the white city, you know, the natives attacking Columbus's ships for like the fourth or fifth time that day, Buffalo Bill's Wild West show, I started to get sad again, you know, just really at this point beyond the point of enjoying it all. Because I realized in that moment that this is why the Get Back Travel Agency had opened the 1893 Chicago World's Fair for travel. Because it was a controllable space. You know, there was literally nothing you could do here that you couldn't do in your own time. And the crowd was so big that you could blend into it. You could actually have no identity. Like, almost the way you do in any vacation where you're just another, like, chump, you know, walking through Disney World or being rushed past the crown jewels at the Tower of London, you know. And it was that moment that I actually began to wonder if this was really real at all. Was I really, were we really in 1893 or just like a theme park? You know, were all the non-fat, forlorn looking people just actors, or were they like robots in Westworld? And I began to wonder why they had set us up with these phony identities, and they took us through the whole rigmarole of learning how to speak 1890s pioneer. You know, nobody had even talked to us so far, really, or taken the time to get to know our story. There were no gentlemen I was sitting around smoking cigars and drinking bourbon with and talking about all the politicians in Washington getting off their nut. Nobody cared that we were from Cedar Rapids, much less if we were having a tally-ho time. I don't know. Yeah, I mean, we were just basically passing through it all. We might as well have been on the people mover the whole time, you know? I mean, it just made me wonder, was this all just some big theater of life, like the way they give you a phony ID at the spy museum at the Washington, D.C., you know? Yeah, and so finally, you know, we get off the Ferris wheel and, again, just fighting that kind of depression. And I normally get depressed at the end of any vacation, you know, just because I had seen everything, but I still am not ready to go home yet. And I just start thinking of all the stuff I got to do when I get back to 2022. It's like, do the dishes. I got a bunch of laundry to wash. You know? Yeah. So, you know, Jessica and I, we just decided we were just kind of reluctantly submitting to the business of becoming a tourist because... Jessica, at that moment, spotted a fudge tent. She said, oh, it's the place where they make the fudge, right? So, yeah, it was like, you know, getting fudge is kind of the height of just being, I don't know, just a passive tourist, you know? But I just said, what the hell, you know, we've come this far, right? So we went in, you know, in the fudge tent. It was like any other fudge tent in 2022 Gatlinburg, Tennessee. I tasted the fudge, and the only really astonishing thing about the whole experience was that nothing had changed about the taste of fudge in 130 years. Right? It was just all the same. It's kind of interesting, though, when you eat fudge now, you're tasting the same taste as your great-great-grandparents tasted. I don't know if they ate fudge. Yeah. So I looked to the, you know, to the kid who was running the booth. I said to him, you know, thank you kindly, right? You know, the kid was dressed like a typical, you know, phosphate and sweet vendor of the time. He had a handlebar mustache tickling his cheeks, you know, he had a tight-fitting vest and all that. And then something weird happened with him. He said back, after I thanked him, he said back, not a thing, Mr. Heppelwhite. And I stopped in my tracks. It was like weird that the kid used, like, such modern slang, and also that he knew my name or my false name. And I watched him just like facepalm, and he was like, oh, shit. He identified his blunder and he said, sorry, sir, you know, I'm just an employee of the Get Back Travel Agency. My name's Tim, right? So, yeah. So we said, oh, hey, Tim, so why are you here? And he's like, well, they just like to place us places, you know, at the fair just to make sure you're having a good time, getting along well, not getting Cheeto dust on anything. So, you know. And, you know, yeah, and I will say that after this whole day of just kind of being constantly sort of slightly let down by everything, right? Finding myself in another time and place, which was amazing, but in a lot of ways being more restricted than I would be on any other vacation. I actually found it fun and to talk to a person from my own time for once, right? And so, yeah, Tim just talked to us. He asked us if we were enjoying the fair, and I gave him a somewhat dishonest answer, and I think he sensed my disappointment at that moment, you know? And he told us that, yeah, this isn't my favorite era to work in either, you know? He said he'd rather be in the 1980s Sunset Strip timeline working the door at the Whiskey-A-Go-Go. seeing acts like Poison and Motley Crue get their start. Yeah, and then he said, you know, he could really get something out of the job then, you know. Yeah, I just talking to Tim more and more, I could tell he was one of those guys who had been born at the turn of the 21st century. You know, he was all hopped up for a past that he had never been a part of. He was a millennial, essentially. And, you know, everything he had in his life was he was dedicated to achieving that vision of himself, right? Of being in a band. You know, he said he had a band. It was a kind of a thrash metal jazz fusion type thing called Satan's Landlord, right? Yeah, he talked to us about his band for a while and all that. And said, I used to play the keys, but now I play the drums, right? Yeah. And then he said something else interesting. He asked us if we had been to the H.H. Holmes murder castle yet. And I was like, no, I had no idea we could actually go there. It's like a private residence, and he's a serial killer. And he said, oh, man, but it comes with your ticket. You should totally go. And at that point, he offered to actually gladly walk us over to the murder castle. You know, he said he was working a double that day in 1893, and he was covering for the guy who normally ran tours of the murder castle. But he said that once his relief got there, he was out of there. He wouldn't even say goodbye to us because he had to be at band practice back in 2022. And he had to get his sister's car back, right? So, yeah. So, yeah, as he walked us over we started walking over to the murder castle, you know. He escorted us out of the fairgrounds and over to West 63rd Street, where I'm told it was. And there was a pharmacy there. And from reading the book, right, I knew that from reading the book that this pharmacy Holmes actually owned. The previous owner suspiciously disappeared. And he bought this pharmacy, and then he started building this house above it and hiring multiple crews because he was essentially building a death trap on one big city block there in Southside Chicago, a couple of blocks from where the World's Fair was. Right. And what he would do is he would actually prowl this fair, and he would just like pick up unsuspecting single women, sometimes men too. He would bring them back to his house, and they were never seen again, you know. And yeah, I thought at this moment this was kind of like amazing. Okay, so like if this actually was something I could do, it would kind of make up for the rest of the trip sort of sucking, right? Because the White City had burned down, and I did get to walk through it, but the murder castle, right, burned down several years after H.H. Holmes was eventually caught and hanged. And it's a fascinating house, and I was so ready to go into it because this is one thing I could not do in 2022, right? So, yeah. I asked the kid, though, I was a little nervous. I said, is this dangerous? Because this is the known residence of a currently active serial killer, you know, the first America ever had, okay? And he said, nah, don't worry about it, brah, you know. He said the agents, you know, like they engineered this particular day to be void of any H.H. Holmes activity. It was a day when he was out of town seeing a friend in Springfield. So we were fine. That's good. So yeah, we were free to walk around the house. We were free to explore its intricate passageways that went to nowhere. People would get trapped in those passageways looking for a way out, and he would come up behind them. They would try to open a door to escape, but there'd be nothing but a brick wall behind the door. It's really macabre stuff, man. You know? We walked down into the dungeon where, you know, Holmes stood over his victims in their final agonizing moments of life. I did feel morally strange about this, right? More so than when I was at the Louisiana Pavilion and stood idle as those Gilded Age rubes gawked at the cypress tree. You know, I was standing in a place where people had died and where many more people would die before Holmes would be found out, brought to justice, and hanged a year later, okay? Yeah, and I figured that this was the ultimate quandary of time travel, you know. you could know, but you couldn't help. And I tried to rationalize this in my head of being like, I'm here. I could actually warn people. I know that I would probably incur a pretty big fine from the federal government if I did that, but I could stand here and help people, right? So, yeah, I tried to rationalize it in my mind, and I remember this old Adam Sandler album, this comedy album he had, right, where he has, like, these several tracks on the album where, like, a lunch lady, a school janitor, a bus driver, they get beaten up in really terrible ways. And I remember in the liner notes, you know, Adam Sandler say, hey, don't worry about their safety. You know, they're all rapists and all that stuff. You know, they're bad people. Okay, it's good that they're being beaten up. So I was thinking, you know, maybe H.H. Holmes, you know, killed people who were actually bad, you know, like killers or bestialists or something like that. I don't know, right? But yeah. Yeah. So, you know, finally, we came to a vault. And this gave me the chills because I recognized this vault from the book and the pictures in it as the place where Holmes would trap his victims and turn off the air, asphyxiating them before he could put them in a chute that would then send them into a vat of acid in the dungeon, where they would be stripped of their skin, and then Holmes would then sell their skeletons to medical schools and doctors' offices around the country. I mean, it was really, really unnerving to look into this vault. And I was just silent next to Jessica for a very long time. And then the kid asked me, so, are you guys up for the escape room? It's like, what? It's like, I really literally cannot believe how much of 21st century tourism tropes was alive in the 1890s. It's like, if you've got access to the H.H. Holmes murder castle in 1893, and you know that you can do whatever you want to because you're in a timeline where he's away in Springfield visiting a friend for a day, of course you're going to turn his house into an escape room, right? He assured us it was perfectly safe, of course. He said the object of the game was to escape the vault before Holmes returned later that night. And he said that no matter what the outcome, don't worry about it. We'll pull you out. We'll yank you out of there before, you know, you could be his next victims. You know. So, yeah, even though Jessica's very claustrophobic and has never, ever agreed to do an escape room with me before, you know, she reluctantly agreed. So we went on in there. And the kid closed the door. So yeah, it was pretty much typical of any other escape room you might encounter. You know, they set up a bunch of puzzles for us to solve. You know, put this here to get a code to go there and all that stuff. And it was all very cheesy, you know, and not very authentic anyway. I know that Holmes would have never done anything like this. You know, he wasn't a Riddler. You know, he would just kill you. But, you know, I went along with it anyway. I don't know. I went along with it anyway because, you know, we were there and we might as well. So, yeah. But yeah, there was a clock on the wall that counted down the minutes until Holmes would arrive and let us know how long we had. I looked at it as like, how much longer do we have to do this? Because after a few minutes, I was just getting a little apprehensive, right? And yeah, after a series of increasingly, you know, like tricky puzzles that we had to solve, we were more like, you know, we were patting ourselves on the back. I mean, you know, it's not that easy to do some of these escape rooms. And I will say that even though we knew that we were going to be safe and H.H. Holmes was actually there out in the world, and if he caught us, he would very much kill us. We had enough faith in the Get Back travel agency by now to sort of feel comfortable that we were going to be okay. So, yeah. So, you know, we did the last puzzle. We solved the last puzzle, which is, you know, the process of basically assembling, I don't know, like a big Connect 4 contraption to make a Rube Goldberg machine that unlocked the door, right? We unlocked the final door, and it opened up a little thing that said, "Congratulations, you've escaped H.H. Holmes. You know, please, you know, see the kid for your shoes on the way out." I don't know. Some message like that. Okay. And at that moment, we expected, you know, the heavy metal kid who was, you know, dressed as, you know, H.R. Pemberton, the inventor of Coca-Cola, we expected him to open the door and let us out, but there was no sound. So we yelled a little bit louder. It's like, "Hey, sir, we're done. Can you let us out, please?" It's like still no answer, right? And at this point, you know, we heard the clock, right? Yeah. And we were like, "Where is he?" We awaited a reply. So like as the hours went down to minutes, we started to actually panic a little bit. You know, like, where was this kid? Did we do something wrong? Did he go to the bathroom from eating a little bit too much of that fudge? What happened? Right? Yeah. And yeah, finally we were down to just like a couple of minutes. And this is where the panic really set in. With just a couple minutes left, we knew that Holmes would certainly be exiting his carriage, charming his 19th century cab driver with a 5-star review, and walking up the stone steps to his door at 63rd West. I just started huddling in a corner thinking that I was going to be appearing as a victim in that very same Eric Larson book that I was holding in the storage compartment of the transport that would never see me go back to the year 2022. I was just like sobbing. I was like, why did I choose this timeline where we knew that America's first serial killer was on the loose? Right? Like, why didn't we just attend the premiere of Star Wars in 1977 or go see the Talking Heads first show at CBGB in New York? Why did we do this? And as we were mulling over all these possibilities, suddenly we heard a twist of the doorknob and expected to see Holmes in his big black hat and top hat standing before us. But instead, it was Mr. Van Allen. He was there. I had never been so happy to see a pudgy bureaucrat in my entire life. Oh, my God. Yeah. I asked him what had happened to the kid, and he said that his relief shift was running late, so he bailed on the job. The kid turned off his cell phone, and he had basically quiet quit. And Mr. Van Allen just looked at us, and he shrugged, and he said, "Damn millennials." Yeah, he brought us on back to 2022, gave us a huge apology for the kid who had slacked off on the job, left without letting anybody know where he was going, right? And as a token of apology, he offered us, you know, tickets off of our next trip back to wherever we wanted to go in time. You know, he mentioned, you know, "Yeah, we can take you back to 1964, the Beatles appearing on the Ed Sullivan Show, right? I think they just opened a new fudge shop in the lobby of Rockefeller Center." Well, from Birmingham, Alabama, this has been the Midnight Citizen Show. Thank you for going on this journey with me tonight. I'm your host, Mike Booty. Please check me out at mikebooty.com/themidnightcitizen or at youtube.com/mikebooty, where I will be doing regular shows like this every Saturday night. And yeah, live shows on YouTube. It's a great way to spend Saturday night alone at home watching YouTube, right? I'm serious. It's a good time. Yeah. Check me out over at Spotify, Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, whatever platform you listen to. And please check out me and other great guests, great hosts at the place in cyberspace on SUG, onsug.com. That's the Overnightscape Underground. Yeah. And I will be back next week with a regular show, a little bit less loony than this one. Keep your eyes open.